From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Today, the Ohio National Guard opened fire on student protesters at Kent State University. The students were demonstrating against the U.S. invasion of Cambodia. 4 students were killed, 9 were wounded. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Dean Kaler, who was shot in the side, leaving him paralyzed from the waist down. Also today, we talk with conservative political strategist Paul Weyrich. After founding 2 conservative think tanks, he created NET, National Empowerment Television, a conservative public affairs network which broadcasts 2 programs hosted by Newt Gingrich. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. President Clinton is threatening to veto legislation on curbing lawsuit damage awards. The bill is now before the Senate. It seeks to overhaul the legal system and restrain punitive damage awards in all civil suits. Mr. Clinton says that includes limiting damages in suits that victims bring against murderers, rapists, drunken drivers, and other offenders. Mr. Clinton says the Senate should change the bill to remove what he says is undeserved protection for those offenders. The Senate has fallen 7 votes short today in cutting off debate on this bill. Democrats say Republicans have made the legislation so sweeping they may not be able to bring it to a final vote. The United Nations is extremely worried that a fragile ceasefire worked out in Croatia is about to break down and disintegrate into all-out war. Richard Carruthers reports from Zagreb.
In western Slavonia, where Croatian forces began their offensive, a UN plan to enable the retreat of defeated Serb troops and civilians has been jeopardized. A unit of about 200 Serb rebels is refusing to surrender near the town of Pakrac and has launched mortars at Croat positions. The Croats responded with a hail of cannon fire. Croat soldiers are also reported to have looted the town of Okučani, which they captured on Tuesday, despite promising to respect Serbs' human rights. In the Serb stronghold of eastern Slavonia, both sides are now facing one another with tanks. And to the south, some 800 Croatian troops have moved into a demilitarized zone and have taken over 10 UN observation posts. Artillery fire has been heard in the area. For National Public Radio, this is Richard Carruthers in Zagreb.
The Clinton administration has sent its immigration reform bill to Congress. It's intended to speed up the deportation process and punish those who profit from illegal immigration. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports.
Attorney General Reno told reporters the bill beefs up the Border Patrol and allows some deportations without going before an immigration judge. Nations who refuse to take their nationals back would also face sanctions under the bill. Reno also praised a move already made by the administration to weed out immigrants who falsely claim political persecution to get into the U.S.
When I became Attorney General, the country's asylum system was broken. Thousands of aliens were fraudulently claiming that they were victims of political persecution so that they could stay in this country and get the documents they needed to work.
Reno says the new system quickly grants asylum in valid cases and sends those considered false to deportation proceedings. As a result, the number of asylum claims is dropping. Immigration advocates fear the government may be denying valid claims in the process. I'm Peter Kenyon in Washington.
The death toll has reached 150 in the bombing of the Oklahoma City Federal Building. Searchers are sifting through the rubble again. Officials say they've removed 4 more bodies. More than 20 people are still missing, including 3 infants. On Wall Street, the Dow is down 10 points at 4,363. This is NPR. A vigil has been held today at Kent State University marking the 25th anniversary of a fatal clash between anti-war demonstrators and National Guardsmen. The vigil ended at the same time the Guardsmen opened fire on students, killing 4 of them and wounding 9 others. Bells tolled in their memories today. They also rang for 2 students who were killed at Jackson State University in Mississippi 10 days later. The Kent State shootings came after 3 days of unrest over the invasion of Cambodia during the Vietnam War. Then Ohio Governor James Rhodes had ordered the National Guard to restore order in his state. A federal grand jury has indicted a Houston company for defrauding the government. Lisa Garvin of member station KUHF reports from Houston.
The six-count federal indictment released in Houston names the Stewart & Stevenson Company, its CEO Bob O'Neill, and three other executives, accusing them of keeping the cost savings from a 1987 defense contract. Stewart & Stevenson was hired to build generators for use by the Saudi Arabian Royal Air Force as part of a $100 million subcontract for the U.S. Air Force. The indictment alleges that Stewart & Stevenson used cheaper, similar quality parts in the generators and did not pass on the estimated $5 million in savings to the government. The indictments cap a three-year investigation of Stewart & Stevenson. Lawyers for the 92-year-old company say the allegations are untrue. For National Public Radio, I'm Lisa Garvin in Houston.
A Harvard study finds high school dropouts who get a high school equivalency degree make only a little more money than those who do not. Researchers found the average recipient of a general equivalency diploma earned $7.43 an hour 9 years after getting the certificate. High school dropouts who didn't get the GED made $7.02 an hour. One researcher says the study shows getting the GED may be worthwhile, but it's not a good strategy to move low-income people out of poverty. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR, in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. 25 years ago today, at Kent State University, National Guard troops opened fire on students demonstrating against the U.S. invasion of Cambodia, which was the latest escalation of the war in Vietnam. Four students were killed, nine were wounded. My guest, Dean Kaler, was shot in the side under his armpit, leaving him paralyzed from the waist down. The governor of Ohio had called out the National Guard and declared martial law after a series of demonstrations in which local police drove back students with tear gas. During the demonstrations, the campus ROTC building was burned to the ground, and windows of several buildings were smashed with rocks. Dean Kaler was then a conscientious objector who had enrolled in Kent State just a few weeks before the protests. He's now 45, living in Albany, Ohio, but he's spending today in Kent, where he's participating in panel discussions and ceremonies that are being held in remembrance. Dean Kaler was shot on a Monday. His parents had driven him to the Kent State campus the day before. He told me it was like entering a military zone.
It was a checkpoint just to get into the city of Kent. We pulled up to the city limits. My dad had to show his ID, and I showed mine, my mother hers, and we had to state our purpose, had to state how long we were going to be there, and he was ready to turn around and go back at that point. But my mother and father and I talked it out and decided that since I was paying for my own education that I would go to my dorm and stay on campus and stay out of trouble, basically.
And why had the National Guard been called to the Kent State campus?
They were called to the Kent State campus because the mayor felt that he could not control the students that were in that city. He obviously thought that the students were going to take over the city after Richard Nixon's announcement about the invasion of Cambodia. There apparently on Friday night was a spring riot that had happened, and he assumed that it was more than that, I think, and thought the whole town was going to go up in smoke.
Did you think of yourself at the time as an activist or a radical?
No, I didn't. I thought of myself as a patriot and a fairly conservative Democrat.
So what made you decide to go to the demonstration on Monday?
Well, I had a 1 o'clock class, and I figured that I would go see a demonstration. I hadn't been to very many because I was a farm boy as a kid growing up and didn't spend a lot of time doing things other than milking cows. And I went there, first of all, to see one. Second of all, to lend my voice to the opposition of the invasion of Cambodia. And thirdly, to find out what my rights and responsibilities were that day. We'd heard so many conflicting reports. Was martial law declared? Were we going to stay on campus? Was campus going to stay open? How late could we stay out at night? We didn't know what our responsibilities were.
I'd like you to describe what you remember of the first part of the demonstration before the shooting.
Well, I really didn't see much of a demonstration. I remember getting there, and there was people hollering through a bullhorn about communism, socialism, and Marxism, and capitalism, and imperialism, and I was wondering what all this meant in relation to the invasion into Cambodia, and it didn't seem very organized. There wasn't any real leadership going on at this point in time. I was actually a little bit bored. I remember sitting there thinking, boy, this is a nice day. It's really warm. Feels good for the first time in northeastern Ohio that spring. And, I was just sitting there watching and enjoying what was going on around me. It really wasn't very well organized until the Ohio National Guard troops came out and with a campus security guard reading the riot act to the students.
Literally reading the riot act.
Exactly. Ohio had a riot act at that point in time. In fact, they still do.
Did you hear it read?
Yes, I did.
Do you remember what it said?
Well, basically said that we were to cease and desist in this gathering and that we had to leave the premises immediately. And there was a quotation of various Ohio Revised Code sections at that point.
Did you realize that the National Guard had rifles?
Oh, yeah, you could see them. They had rifles with bayonets fixed to them.
Did you think that they were going to use the rifles?
No, this is a college campus. It's a bastion of free speech. It's an area where you're allowed to discuss controversial issues without a threat of being shot. And besides, we had a First Amendment, too. From my understanding, Kent still is in the United States. So I did not feel that something like a shooting would ever occur. They might beat some of us over the heads. They might club us with, hand-to-hand type combat things using their weapons, but I didn't suspect that they would shoot anybody.
Was there any warning that they would shoot?
No warning at all. They marched up to the top of the hill after they were down on the practice football field, and the right flank of them basically turned in unison and started shooting. And I remember hearing the bullets ricocheting around me and said, oh, my God, they're shooting at me. And at that point in time, I jumped on the ground, covered my head, and was praying that I wouldn't get shot. And next thing I know, I got hit in the back right behind the shoulder blade on the left side.
Was there a moment where you could tell things are escalating right now, they're actually going to shoot? Was there a change that you perceived that you felt could account in some way for the escalation?
Really, I didn't see any escalation. if you look at all the photographs, and I remember thinking to myself, there's really hardly anybody around here right in front of them when they were shooting. I didn't know what they were shooting at because if they were shooting at students, all they had to do was turn to their left slightly, and they could have shot several hundred students very easily right on the veranda at Taylor Hall within 10 feet of them, who were much closer than I was at 100 yards away. So I saw no escalation. I saw them marching up the top of the hill and then just turn and fire and shot at us.
So when you heard the shooting, you did what?
Jumped on the ground and covered my head.
What was it like on that moment of impact when you knew you were hit? Did you realize it was a bullet that struck you?
Yes, I did. It felt like a bee sting, to tell you the truth. I had been studying the central nervous system in mammals in my zoology class in the first 5 weeks, and I knew that I had received a spinal cord injury. I also had an extensive background in first aid, being a Boy Scout, and I knew that I had a back injury as well, so I knew immediately that I had been hit, and I checked to make sure I wasn't bleeding profusely somewhere so I could put pressure on it and stop it. But I wasn't, and I was still conscious, and I just hoped that the shootings would stop and I wouldn't get hurt again, shot again, and I didn't. And I remember laying there thinking, oh my God, what am I going to do now? And then someone came to me and said, who are you, and what's your parents' phone number? And they apparently got one of the last phone calls out of Kent at that point in time, called my parents. And then 15, 20 minutes later, the ambulances came and hauled us to the hospital.
What else went through your mind when you realized that you were hit?
Well, I remember thinking, God, I mean, it was a lot of chaos. I mean, people were screaming. Shrieks were just filling the air along with the sounds of the rounds being discharged. And then when the shooting stopped, there was a very pause for a moment, and then the shrieks and the screaming resumed, but it was shrieks of horror and seeing 13 of their fellow students lying on the ground, bleeding and dying, some of them.
When did you find out that you were paralyzed from the waist down?
About the time that I got shot.
You knew that right away?
Yes, yeah. Yeah, I knew that when you damage the spinal cord, it's a pretty serious accident, and your chances of recovering full use of whatever was below the area that was damaged was pretty slim. So I knew immediately that I was probably paralyzed for the rest of my life.
Was your life in jeopardy?
Oh, yes. I remember getting to the hospital and hearing doctors hollering, get blood types on all these people. And I remember reaching into my wallet and pulling out my driver's license, my Social Security card, my insurance card, my student ID, and my blood donor's card, put that on top and gave it to the technician as soon as they arrived. And she said, this may save your life. I said, well, I hope so. And the doctors told my parents that when they were finished operating on me after 4 or 5 hours that, you know, they did everything they could. And if I lived for an hour, I might live for another hour. And it was touch and go there for 24 hours, 48 hours until I stabilized.
How did your parents take this?
Very badly. My mother gained 50 pounds. My father lost 50 pounds. And I was the oldest son in a rural agricultural family. And it was tough to deal with. My father felt guilty he felt extremely bad that, you know, his son was shot with the same weapon he carried in the Philippines and Okinawa and in World War II. You know, he's carrying a bullet from an M1 rifle. That hurt my father tremendously that his government could do that to his son.
How did you take it? What mix of bitterness, anger, depression did you experience?
Yeah, I was angry. I was bitter. I was upset. That something like this could happen to me. But having the background that I had as a member of the Church of the Brethren, and as some people call us, the Dunkers, forgiveness and love are two things that are very important to the Brethren. And I've worked hard to find that in my heart for those people who shot me, and I think I've worked my way through it. I also used a combination of playing wheelchair basketball and running wheelchair track. Within 1 year after getting shot, I was one of the top 20 racers in my classification in the 100-yard dash in a wheelchair. So I used a combination of my religious background, my training in that area. I had strong family friendships and support and strong community support to help me overcome my anger and my bitterness.
My guest is Dean Kaler. 25 years ago today, he was shot by the Ohio National Guard during a student anti-war protest on the Kent State University campus. The bullet left him paralyzed from the waist down. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Twenty-five years ago today, four students were killed, nine were wounded by the National Guard during anti-war protests on the Kent State campus. My guest, Dean Kaler, was one of the wounded. Did you ever meet the National Guardsman who shot you?
Well, I probably did because I've been in the same room with all of those who pulled the trigger that day, and who knows who shot me. The bullet that hit me went through something before it hit me, whether it be a tree branch or a ricochet off the ground, because it's larger than a normal entry wound.
You were in the same room with them in court or someplace else?
In the court, yeah. In the courtroom only, yeah.
Did you have any direct conversation with the guardsmen?
Yes, we did. I mean, they were sitting right there, and we used the same restrooms, we used the same hallways, we ate in the same restaurants. So we had conversations, but there was really no conversations about that day. They didn't want to talk about it. They wouldn't talk about it. They've mouthed the same story for 25 years. That doesn't make sense to me, that they were ready to be overrun, that they were in fear of their lives, that they had to use force necessary to protect themselves. And that doesn't add up. You sit and look at all the photographs. that day, and you can take all the photographs, line them up in a row, and you can flip right through them, and it's like watching a motion picture. Students were not ready to overrun the National Guards. Students were not ready to take their weapons away from them. There wasn't a horde of students ready to disarm them. There were very few people who were close to them that were doing anything at all. It doesn't make sense.
In talking about that day, guardsmen had also said that they were fearful of the rocks being thrown. There was a guardsman who fell who apparently, I think, fainted or something for some reason, but some guardsmen said that they thought this other guardsman who fell had been shot.
Well, if that's part of their excuse, I think he fainted and fell long before the shootings happened. He was wearing a gas mask. The temperature was in the 60s. They were in full combat gear. They had their flak jackets on, their field jackets on, they had helmets on, they had gas masks on. Some of them even had gloves on. So I'm sure it was purely from exhaustion and possibly being out of shape.
Have you ever received any official apologies?
The only apology that I have received is from Governor Dick Celeste 5 years ago. In 1979, during the settlement of the lawsuit that we had filed against the Ohio National Guard and the governor of the state of Ohio, they gave us a statement saying that they took responsibility for the shooting, they shouldn't have shot us, and they were wrong for shooting us. But they've never come out and said, we are sorry. But I accept what they said as an apology, and I think that's part of my forgiving nature.
After the shootings at Kent State, President Nixon said, this should remind us that when dissent turns to violence, it invites tragedy. What was your reaction to that?
Well, I think that's so much rhetoric that Richard Nixon was using to create the scene. The Justice Department report have all stated that the shootings at Kent State were unnecessary, unwarranted, and inexcusable. And that's from a John Mitchell Justice Department. It's not from, you know, from what one would expect. So violence was not perpetrated by students. That was a peaceful demonstration there happening that way. It was a peaceful gathering. President's Commission on Student Unrest even said that the only violence that day was perpetrated by the Ohio National Guard, and so did the Justice Department report. So Richard Nixon's remarks to me were purely for staging and purely for political gain and purely to incite the, as he called it, silent majority.
You, for two terms, were county commissioner in Athens, Ohio. Is that right?
Athens County, yes.
That was from 85 to 93. I was surprised when I found out that you ran for office. I just found it very interesting that after being shot by the National Guard, you decided that you wanted to become more active in local politics.
My father always said to me, if you're going to say no to a problem and you say you don't like something, you have to do something positive about it. You have to find a resolution. And to me, I didn't want anybody to control my life that didn't have responsibility for it. And I felt it was important for me to be involved in the government process even more after getting shot. It's to keep people like that from abusing their power.
Your two terms as county commissioner in Athens County, Ohio, ended in 1993. What have you been doing professionally since then?
Well, I've done a couple of things. I worked for the Attorney General of the state of Ohio for a while, helping to develop an education program. That was Mr. Lee Fisher at the time. He's no longer the Attorney General. And then I worked for a small two-year college called Hocking College on a grant program. And when the grant monies ran out, my job ran out. So last year, I applied for 6 teaching jobs. I have a degree in education. I've always wanted to teach. If I hadn't gotten shot, I probably would have taught and then maybe run for office at some time in the future. But my career seemed to have got flip-flopped, and I became involved in politics early in my life. And so I've been, this year, getting, as the principals I interviewed with last year, saying I needed current measurable experience. So I've done that as a substitute teacher, and I've taken some courses to upgrade my certificate even more, and hopefully next fall I will have a job teaching social studies somewhere.
Do you get any kind of disability payments?
No, huh? No. I get subpay from the schools that I work in.
The 25th anniversary of the Kent State shootings coincides more or less with the bombing of the federal building in Oklahoma City. And that bombing appears to be tied in with the extremist right. And we're becoming more aware now of extremist anti-government sentiments on the right. I wonder what you make of that.
Extremist right sentiments are all part of what makes us United States. I think violence and destruction of property is not a way to solve a problem. I think the people who are doing these kinds of things are, as President Clinton said, evil cowards. And that's exactly what I call them, evil cowards. People who can't stand up, can't take the responsibility, won't identify themselves, are evil cowards. I did not do that 25 years ago. I stood up as an individual. I've not backed down. I've made everyone know what my positions were, and I've taken responsibilities for my actions.
Did you still have a lot of questions about what happened that day?
Well, I guess my only real question is, I would hope at some point in time, National Guard troops would sit down and tell us the real truth, why they shot 13 students on the Kent campus that day.
I think the most famous image from the Kent campus the day of the shootings is the image of Marianne Vecchio crying over the body of a dead student.
Yeah.
Is there any photograph of you right after you were shot?
There's one photograph of a group of students who are standing around me, and that's about it. I think there's like three photographs taken of me that day. Having been a boy who grew up in a rural environment, I didn't want to get too close to people who were carrying weapons, and I stayed far away from them. I tried to stay 100 yards away. I figured that was a safe distance. I didn't want to get in trouble. I didn't want to get beat up by anybody. And so there's very few photographs taken of me that day. And I know of only one photograph of me laying on the ground.
How do you feel when you look at it?
Well, I really don't see myself. All I see is a crowd of students standing around me. And so I don't even see myself. I just see this group of people surrounding me. But I remember laying there that day and looking up and seeing the horror and the disgust and the shock on these students' faces. And, you know, what they were seeing, I mean, the reaction on their face was very frightening to me. I felt these poor people, what have they witnessed? It was pretty sobering to see their faces looking at me as I was laying on the ground.
Dean Kaler, thank you very much for talking with us.
You're welcome, Terry.
Dean Kaler was shot by the National Guard 25 years ago today during an anti-war protest on the Kent State University campus. Our thanks to WKSU in Kent, Ohio. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. After creating two conservative think tanks and providing the name for the group The Moral Majority, Paul Weyrich created the conservative political news talk network National Empowerment Television. Weyrich is one of the hosts. The network carries a program co-hosted by Newt Gingrich and also broadcasts his history course. We'll talk with Paul Weyrich about his television network and about conservative political strategy coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. At her weekly briefing for reporters, Attorney General Janet Reno said she's disappointed the elusive second suspect in the Oklahoma City bombing hasn't been caught. FBI investigators have detained and questioned many John Doe No. 2 lookalikes, but all have been released. Reno says they still have a large number of leads to pursue.
When you talk about a disappointment, it is a disappointment that John Doe 2 has not been identified or taken into custody. But it is also important that people who are not guilty, who are not implicated, are quickly clarified as such. And so I'm glad that that process worked where those very unusual coincidences took place.
The two men picked up in question for 18 hours on Tuesday have been asked to appear before a grand jury investigating the case. Meanwhile, Oklahoma City officials say more victims of the bombing have been pulled from the wreckage. The number of confirmed dead is now 152. Two dozen people are missing. Mayor Ron Norick says once workers and the FBI have finished their work inside the federal building, the city plans a private ceremony there for the families of victims, as well as workers and police involved in the search. Turkish defense officials say that the month-and-a-half-long battle against Kurdish rebels in northern Iraq is over. NPR's Suni Khalid reports from Cairo.
Turkish Defense Minister Mehmet Golan told reporters that his government had withdrawn 20,000 troops from northern Iraq, completing a pullout that began last month. In March, Turkey sent an estimated 35,000 troops backed by armor and aircraft to strike at 20 suspected rebel bases of the Kurdish Workers' Party. The incursion drew sharp criticism from some of Turkey's NATO allies, including France and Germany. The Clinton administration also pressured Turkish Prime Minister Tansu Çiller to order withdrawal from northern Iraq during her visit last month to Washington. And Turkey was accused of human rights abuses during raids that created thousands of refugees. Meanwhile, Turkish defense officials also said they would be building bases along the Iraqi border in an attempt to prevent future infiltration by Kurdish rebels. I'm Suni Khalid in Cairo.
The State Department says that two Americans serving 8-year jail terms in Iraq have medical problems that require their release on humanitarian grounds. A spokesman is calling for Baghdad to let go William Barloon and David Daliberte, who've been held since mid-March. They were convicted of crossing the border from Kuwait illegally, but both maintain they accidentally strayed across. The Iraqi government hasn't responded to the appeal. Barloon has been hospitalized twice for heart problems and Daliberte once for unknown reasons. A Polish diplomat who's been trying to meet with them has been prevented from doing so on several occasions. Stock prices closed lower on Wall Street today. The Dow fell about 13 points to end the day at 4,359. Though at one point it was above 4,400. Advances led to declines in heavy trading. This is NPR. The Senate could vote very quickly on the nomination of John Deutsch as the new chief of the CIA. His confirmation is expected. The Senate Intelligence Committee unanimously recommended that the full Senate approve Deutsch, who's currently Deputy Defense Secretary. Deutsch is only part of what's expected to be a broad shakeup in CIA management. The head of the intelligence agency's operations division says he's resigning tomorrow after more than 30 years with the agency. Deutsch has said if he's confirmed, he'll put new people in several top jobs at the agency. Meanwhile, the White House says it's encouraged about the progress of Surgeon General nominee Henry Foster. Spokesman Mike McCurry says he believes Dr. Foster can be confirmed if the Senate, quote, gives him the chance he deserves. Cincinnati will no longer fund free condom distribution for its citizens. Marianne Zalesnik of member station WNKU reports.
The Cincinnati City Council voted to cut off funding for the health department's free distribution of condoms despite opposition from Health Commissioner Malcolm Adcock. Adcock noted last year, Cincinnati had its greatest number of reported syphilis cases in 40 years. Councilmember Bobby Stern, who voted against the proposal, says the council should leave public health matters to experts. But the majority, in favor of the proposal, says the free distribution of condoms encourages irresponsible sex among teenagers. The Cincinnati Inquirer reports Dallas is the only other U.S. city to ban condom distribution. For National Public Radio, I'm Marianne Zalesnik reporting.
Dow Corning Corporation says it's considering filing for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection because of several issues relating to the company's silicone gel breast implants. A Dow Corning vice president says no decision has been made, but the company is actively considering several options. Dow Corning isn't satisfied with progress being made toward resolving the breast implant lawsuits. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Paul Weyrich is a leading conservative strategist. He founded two political think tanks, the Heritage Foundation and the Free Congress Foundation. He came up with the name for Jerry Falwell's group, the Moral Majority. In late 1993, Weyrich created a conservative political news talk network called National Empowerment Television. Newsweek called it the first of its kind, an unabashedly ideological political TV channel. NET reaches about 11 million homes. Weyrich hosts a show. Newt Gingrich co-hosts a program. The network also carries Gingrich's history lectures to his college class. I asked Paul Weyrich to describe the network.
NET, the Political News Talk Network, is a 24-hour public affairs channel, which is sort of brash and irreverent and anti-establishment. We do 8 hours of original programming a day and then essentially repeat it twice. And we are now carried on cable systems and broadcast channels around the country that reach over 11 million homes.
I'm always confused about how one can be anti-government and anti-establishment when, for instance, Newt Gingrich has two shows on NET. And I know on one level he's anti-establishment, on the other level he is the establishment. He's the Speaker of the House. He's been a Washington force for many years now. So have you been a Washington force for many years now?
Well, but I've never been in power. This is Newt's first opportunity at being in power, and we are skeptical of all people that are in power. We've done many commentaries that question things that he's done, that question things that other Republicans have done. This is not a Republican channel. It is a channel that takes a critical look, if you will, at what is happening in our nation's capital as well as elsewhere in the country.
What politically inspired NET?
Well, I have been involved in the political process for a long time. I worked in the United States Senate, founded the Heritage Foundation, Free Congress Foundation, and so on. And, I have been concerned about the direction of public policy in this country for a long time. So we produce a lot of materials at our little think tank, which I've often called the best secret in the country, because while we had some minimal impact in Washington, we were not terribly well known around the country. And I felt that this provided us with an opportunity to put some of the experts that we had developed in our think tank on the air and let them develop a national audience for their viewpoint. And in fact, that has happened.
Do you think that the media in general has a liberal bias, which is a point of view that I think some conservatives have?
Well, I worked in the media, and I was one of the few dissenting voices in the media properties that I worked at. So I don't think I know. When I was press secretary to a member of the Senate leadership during the Johnson and Nixon administrations, I can tell you that the media that I dealt with, many of whom are still around, definitely started with a different premise and outlook than I did.
For example?
Well, when, for example, there were riots in Los Angeles and Watts in the 1960s, when the Kent State incident occurred, for example, I think in 1970 and so on. The kinds of questions that we got, that Senator Allet got, who was Gordon Allet was chairman of the Republican Policy Committee, all started with the premise that the people who had initiated these riots were fully justified, and that it was the people who were attempting to stop the riots who were at fault. I don't happen to accept that point of view. And if you questioned that, as my senator did, why you got very sharp questioning and angry retorts, much as you get today.
You've said that when you first got to Washington, you learned how the game was played by watching liberals. What do you think you learned from watching liberals that you've applied to conservative politics?
Well, liberals learned how to organize. They learned how to frame issues. They learned how to seize the moral high ground. They learned how to integrate the work of think tanks and politics inside the United States Congress with political action on the outside and so on. And all of this they did very, very well, because there was a time when liberals were also on the outside. I mean, the establishment, if you will, in the country was very conservative. And so these people had to apply unique techniques in, say, the 1950s to get where they eventually got by the 1960s. And so I looked at all of that. I looked at the campaign schools that they had run. I looked at the think tanks that they had built. I looked at the various operations that they had, and decided that conservatives weren't on the same playing field, that we were forfeiting every game because they were playing one type of ball and we were playing another. And so I spent a good portion of my life here trying to invent organizations which would fulfill a vacuum which was created by their initiatives. I have great admiration for a lot of the stuff that they've done. I don't agree with it. But in terms of the way in which they learned to operate, there was a lot of brilliance associated with it.
My guest is Paul Weyrich, the founder of National Empowerment Television and the conservative think tanks the Heritage Foundation and the Free Congress Foundation. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Paul Weyrich is my guest. Well, you helped to create the Moral Majority. You were the founding president of the conservative think tank, the Heritage Foundation, and the founder of the Free Congress Foundation. So how do you think conservative think tanks like the Heritage Foundation, the Free Congress Foundation, are helpful in the conservative political arena? What do they provide?
Well, if you're a legislator, and the reason, by the way, that that I've founded Heritage along with Ed Fulner is because the two of us, one working on the Senate side, the other working on the House side, had the experience of having members of Congress that wanted to involve themselves in certain issues but had no backup. There was no one capable on the staffs. At that time, the minority representation in the Congress was very low, so if you weren't in control of the Congress, you maybe had, like my senator was on appropriations, we had one staffer for virtually all of the senators that were on appropriations. And the majority had a lot of staffers, but we didn't. And so you didn't have the opportunity to investigate. You didn't have the opportunity to gather data and so on. And so we founded that to really assist members of Congress who wanted to fight battles and who wanted the intellectual backup and the data to do so, because it simply wasn't available in-house for the most part. And that was the whole purpose of founding Heritage. Of course, it has now taken on a much greater role and now has a sort of national reach. But at the time, that was our objective.
And the Free Congress Foundation?
More or less the same. It's just that Heritage elected not to get into certain issues like judicial reform, like family-related issues, and so Free Congress was essentially founded to fill the gap, if you will, in the three-quarters of the circle that Heritage did, and then there was the quarter that they didn't do, and Free Congress was founded to do the extra quarter.
I'd like to talk with you a little bit about the bombing in Oklahoma City. With the information that we have now, and the information we have now is still very incomplete, are you inclined to see the bombing as an expression of larger organized forces like the radical militias, or are you now seeing it as the work of individuals, individual psychotics?
Oh, I think by what information we have now, you would have to say that probably it was some imbalanced individuals who were outraged and who decided to take matters into their own hands, which is absolutely reprehensible. I don't, at this stage, see the connection between them and other organizations around the country. I mean, it may be that later revelations will prove that there are some connections, but at this stage, I don't think you can make that allegation.
The bombing has certainly cast a lot of light on the radical militias organized in many states around the country. How concerned are you about them, about how armed they are, and about how angry they are at the American government?
Well, first of all, a lot of militias are chartered by local governments or sanctioned by state governments and so on. I think you have to distinguish between those that have been set up, for example, to assist the police, who in this day and age have a virtually impossible job, and those which have what I would regard as immoral purposes, white supremacy or some sort of radical underground action against the government. And I think that a lot of people are getting an unfair rap because many of these militias have very laudable aims, and it is a perfectly appropriate way for these folks to be involved in the community.
My guest is conservative political strategist Paul Weyrich, the founder of National Empowerment Television. More in a minute. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Well, we'll be hearing today, Terry, about the action of the Federal Communications Commission regarding Rupert Murdoch's U.S. broadcast properties. There's been a question of whether Murdoch's company is American enough to own U.S. Stations as it does. We'll also be hearing about some of the arguments against U.S. sanctions on Iran. We'll be hearing our listeners' letters, also talking with a fellow who's been living up a tree for several weeks in Georgia. And Noah Adams reports on the 25th anniversary of the events at Kent State. He was out there, and we'll hear some of what happened 25 years ago today.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. My guest is Paul Weyrich, the founder of National Empowerment Television and the conservative think tanks the Heritage Foundation and the Free Congress Foundation. You've said that the Republicans must nominate a cultural conservative in order to win the presidency. Why?
Well, because a lot of the people who have been voting for the Republicans are not members of the Republican Party. They are, in fact, Democrats who have found their own party incompatible. If the Republicans offer somebody who is sound on cultural values, they will be inclined to vote for that person, particularly on the national level. Many of these people continue to vote for Democrats on the local level. But if the Republicans nominate somebody who is not good on these issues, and if the Democrats, therefore, have nominated somebody that is not good on these issues, and that would fit Bill Clinton, and I assume he will be the Democratic nominee, then you're going to, end up with a lot of people either looking for a third-party candidate or simply staying home. And if they stay home, the Republicans will be in deep trouble in terms of gaining a national majority.
What conservative values do you think the Republican Party should be emphasizing?
Well, I think that you need to start with the family. The fact of the matter is that all the evidence now shows that when you have a breakdown of the family, it has enormous societal consequences, and that that has to be the primary focus, that, in fact, government should be directed so that it supports the notion of the traditional family. And by traditional family, I'm not talking about, the mother that bakes pies or something. I'm talking about a mother and a father and children. And government policies ought to push in that direction as opposed to pushing in the other direction, which has been the case in the past number of years. Beyond that, of course, there is the matter of life, because in my opinion, a government must first of all protect its people from foreign invasion, which we haven't done very well. We are enormously vulnerable to a missile attack, for example, as things are now. And a government ought to protect the weakest, those who can't protect themselves, and among those, of course, are the unborn. And in my opinion, if a party is not willing to stand for that value, then I'm not sure what value the rest of their pronouncements really is.
What about homosexuality? Do you think the Republican Party should take a strong stand against homosexuality in this election?
Well, I don't think it's an election issue. I mean,
I ask you this because I know you helped on a 1982 book called The Homosexual Agenda. I know that's been an issue for you.
Actually, it was called The Homosexual Network, not Agenda.
Oh, excuse me.
Yes, it was an enormous book produced by Father Enrique Reyda, who looked at the various homosexual organizations and simply categorized what it was they stood for. The fact of the matter is that, again, that relates to the family. Now, I don't want to see a government that harasses individuals, but I don't also want to see a government which says, oh, by the way, it's perfectly okay if you are homosexual, it's a perfectly normal lifestyle, everything is going to be okay, and all of this. That's a lie. And so, in my opinion, what we had in this country over a long period of time was a tolerance of people who kept this to themselves, but, an official view that this is not a normal or appropriate lifestyle. And I think that is a supportable position.
Well, I know that you've worked with Jerry Falwell and you have worked closely with the Christian Coalition. I wonder what you think the difference is politically and strategically between the former Moral Majority and the current Christian Coalition.
Oh, there are enormous differences. First of all, the Christian Coalition folks are a lot more serious about long-term involvement in the political process. The problem with the original group, and it's not just Falwell, it was a whole number of people, most of whom have now passed from the scene as far as active involvement in the political process, they never understood that you have to be committed to the political process in the long term in order to accomplish something. So they wanted to find a political savior. They wanted to have big rallies and try to elect that person president and then go home and forget about it. I told them at the time, this won't work. There are no saviors in politics. And I says, you of all people should know this, and that you have to be committed to join political parties. You have to be committed to elect local officials. people in state legislatures and so on to have a serious impact in the political process. They didn't believe it, and they didn't want to do it, and they didn't. The Christian Coalition people believe it, and the people that they have been recruiting are much more serious, and they're willing to run for school board, and they're willing to run for county commissioner and state legislature and so on, and not insist that the only thing you need is the President of the United States. As I used to say, that these people were sort of monarchists because they thought that, you know, if you just had the right king, that everything else would be fine. And that isn't how our system functions, and never has. So the Christian Coalition people are serious about training their folks. One of the great difficulties that you had with the previous group is that they sent people into battle, so to speak, and I'm talking about politically, unarmed. They didn't train them. And, of course, if you did that in a military sense, people would get killed. Well, of course, their people did get killed in the political sense because they weren't trained, they didn't know what the whole game was about, and they just went into the foray. And you now have, on the part of Christian Coalition as well as other groups, a real desire to see to it that people are armed, that are equipped with an understanding of what the whole process is about, what the issues are about, that they are taught to debate responsibly and not to make statements that aren't supportable, and, you know, all of this sort of thing.
Well, look down the road for me, 5, 10, 20 years from now, if things work out the way you'd like, how would you like to see the local organizing that's going on now, people entering for local office and winning, how would you like to see that affect the national picture?
Well, eventually, if you have governors, as you now have in some states, if you have state legislatures and so on that have people who adhere to traditional values, it is going to impact the congressional scene because these people, especially if there are term limits, by the way, because then these folks are going to get the opportunity to run for Congress, to run for the United States Senate and whatnot. And so eventually, down the road, you will probably have a lot more of them holding national office precisely because they got experience and got credentialed at the local level.
Paul Weyrich is the founder of National Empowerment Television and the conservative think tanks the Heritage Foundation and the Free Congress Foundation. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Alan Tu, Nancy Updike, and Barbara Bogave. Research assistance from Becky Cohn. Today we say goodbye to our versatile intern, Zeb Esselstyn. He'll be spending the summer leading wilderness trips in Wyoming. Good luck, thanks from all of us, and don't forget to take a walk, man. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Crown, publisher of a new Katharine Hepburn biography by Barbara Leeming. This is NPR, National Public Radio.